Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Susan Kalman, and welcome back to Susan Kalman's Mrs. Brightside. Thanks for downloading the show.
I've really taken a step back, and I do use Twitter a bit more to sort of broadcast and then retreat, rather than I don't pick arguments with people anymore. And sometimes, I log into Twitter at like 4 p.m. on a Sunday when I've had a lovely weekend, and there'll be two journalists having a fight that's clearly gone on all day. And I do sort of think, well, that was your weekend. That was your way of spending Sunday. I mean, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Get some hobbies, guys.
Last year, I spoke to 8 people about their tricksy mental health. And this year, I'll be chatting to 8 more.
I genuinely worry that if I... There's nothing bad in my head, but I worry if I talk about genuinely how I feel sometimes...
People would take it too seriously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So instead I make light of it.
And you can't row back from it, going, no, I'm not as ill as I said I was.
Absolutely. And, if you say some of the things and thoughts in your head, you can't take that back.
I'm doing this because I want people to be more open about their mental health, and I know sometimes it can be difficult to define what that means. So we're going to be having a frank and open discussion, no parameters, no written questions, no definitions, and no pop psychology. It's important for you to know that these are not therapy sessions. I am not a qualified psychiatrist, no matter how much Casualty I've watched. They're just honest conversations about what we think and feel about our own heads. This week, I spoke to Isabel Hardman, a journalist who I wasn't afraid to talk to, which makes a change. We talked about everything you can possibly imagine, but mostly wasps.
So Ben's going to start... Have you started recording? Oh, you're recording? Now that's how Ben likes to do things. Thank you very much for coming along. I should say you've rushed here... People in podcasts like to hear that.
Yeah.
You've rushed here
from the news.
From Westminster itself.
Yeah. And is late for your podcast.
But can you ever really be late for a podcast? That's the question.
I like that question.
Podcasts just happen, I think, whenever. That's why I enjoy it. You do a podcast, don't you?
Yes, we do. Yeah. Yeah. Coffee House Shots. We do lots of chin wagging about politics. We got an email through to our address the other day saying, for safety reasons, please keep Ms. Hardman off the podcast, which I quite liked. I thought, if I'm a danger to the public through podcasts,
that's
then
gloriously
I'm really doing
non-specific,
right.
Yeah. Isn't it? Why?
All of these things I'm advocating on the politics podcast.
God, how dangerous.
DIY advice, electrical.
That's amazing. It's why, I love podcasts, the bits that aren't planned. That's why I don't have any questions for you. I'm not sitting with a notebook in front of me because I love those bits. And I do. People take the piss out of it, but I do love Laura Koonsberg on Brexit Cast.
Mm.
She's so inappropriate.
Mm.
The one where she was giving the taxi driver directions and she basically told everyone where she lived.
Oh, God.
Just left the lift at the tube station and it was like, Laura.
What are you doing?
Hod back a bit, love. So to start with, what I always like to do is ask people to introduce themselves and say what you think you do. So I'm not trying to attempt to describe what you do. So please introduce yourself to the millions of people listening to this podcast.
So I'm Isabel Hardman. I'm the assistant editor at The Spectator. So I'm a political journalist. I'm based in the House of Commons full time. I've written a book called Why We Get the Wrong Politicians. But I'm also very, very interested in mental health because a few years ago I had a mental breakdown and I've just finished writing a book about mental health and the great outdoors.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Super.
Yeah.
One of the questions, this actually leads on from Laura Koonsberg, oddly. They did an episode of Brexit Cast, which I found fascinating, which was about the mental health of people currently dealing with Brexit.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean the MPs and the journalists as well.
Yeah.
A lot of people are fed up with people talking about Brexit, blah, blah, blah. There are real people having to deal with what's happening.
Yeah.
What is it like from a journalist point of view and also from what you're seeing of what's happening within Westminster just now?
Yeah, firstly, I think on MPs, it's a culture shock because a lot of the time when you're an MP, you vote as your party tells you to. And people listening to this podcast will be saying, well, that's ridiculous, you know, but why can't they think for themselves? There is a lot in that. But also people come together in political parties in order to achieve stuff. So it kind of figures that you're then, once you're in that party, going to vote with the party. With Brexit, a lot of the decision making is individual. So MPs in, say, Leave supporting constituencies are having to work out what their voters want from them versus what they think might be good for their constituency. Because a lot of MPs campaigned for Remain, and obviously the country voted to leave. And so you've got MPs who think that leaving the European Union is going to damage their constituencies, but their constituents are very, very angry that Brexit hasn't happened yet. And I've been to public meetings where, you know, you've had voters shouting at their MP because Brexit hasn't occurred, even when the MP isn't in the governing party, people storming out. There was one public meeting I went to where clearly the guy, one of the guys who'd come along, had planned to storm out at some point, and he'd left it a bit late, and it was a sort of the roundup bit, and the MP was asking people to vote on what they wanted, whether it was no deal or to remain. And this chap took exception to the questions that were being asked and stormed out. And you could see that he just looked at his watch and thought, oh, God, I haven't stormed out yet. I've just got to do it now. And off he went. So everything's very sort of febrile in the constituency. And then in Parliament, you're having to decide what to do on this really historic issue. And I think it's really discombobulated MPs. And, you know, people might not feel particularly sorry for them that they're actually being forced to do their job a little bit harder than normal. But the atmosphere of abuse, MPs being followed around Westminster, and quite often when I'm cycling out of Parliament in the evenings, hear men across the street, and it has, I have to say, it is mostly men, shouting abuse at people like Anna Soubry as they're walking down, shouting, she's a traitor, and all that kind of thing. And if that doesn't affect you, then there's something quite wrong, actually. MPs who are thick-skinned, like rhinos,
You don't want a sociopath who's not touched by anything that happens to them, although some would argue.
Yeah.
What I find interesting, politics and comedy are similar in many ways. One of them is the use of language, because the language that we use as comedians makes a huge difference. In terms of telling a joke, you can change a joke just by changing a word.
Yeah.
And In mental health terms, and this isn't about politics, so if you're listening to this and thinking, oh God, it's a Brexit discussion, it's not that. This is about the effect of what's happening. So for me, I am disturbed at watching videos of anybody being followed down the street and screamed at.
Yeah.
Because that is a horrific thing to happen.
Yeah.
It's also not how you change anyone's mind, in my view.
It's the least persuasive thing ever, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. But people often say to me, they genuinely do, why didn't you go into politics, Susan? Well, would you like to see a video of someone being screamed at?
Yeah, yeah.
And I just worry about that this is how debate is now, is that I'm going to shout at you.
Yep.
And you can listen to me or not, but I don't care, I'm going to scream at you.
Yep.
And it's vicious, actually.
I think we've forgotten how to live together, actually, that there's not an acceptance that somebody is not going to change their mind just because you have a different view, and that therefore it's somehow okay to not just get angry with them, because I don't think there's anything wrong with getting angry in politics, because there are things that politicians can do which should make us angry. They can make horrendous mistakes that mess people's lives up. You know, you should be angry, for instance, about Grenfell. But when it gets personally vicious, when it gets personally vindictive, personally abusive, just because somebody has a different strain of politics to you, that's as you say, it's not persuasive, but it's also, it attracts a certain type of person into politics, because lots of normal people think, I can't be bothered with that. You know, I don't want to go through this. I don't want to put my family through this. Jess Phillips, the Labour MP, has had to install additional security measures at her own home after threats were made not against her, not against her husband, against her children. Which you just think, well, why would you be an MP? Where's the benefit of that if you're frightened about your child's safety? It puts a lot of normal, decent people off. And I don't think that's good for our politics, because you then get, as you say, people who either don't care about the fact that they're being threatened and abused and told that they're worthless the whole time, or you don't get sort of, you know, decent people going in. And that really worries me.
one of the things that I think has changed dramatically about the current situation. I watched the BBC did a fantastic documentary about Thatcher. I don't know if you saw it. It was a really brilliant documentary. Yeah. Absolutely super duper charting her career and her rise and then her fall. And what was interesting was obviously we didn't have 24-hour news and there were about three journalists she knew.
Yeah.
What happens now with 24-hour news and social media is it's not just the MPs who are being harassed. So As a woman in the public eye, I mean, I stay away from. I just post pictures of cats these days on Twitter to avoid anyone.
You don't get into a cat fight over that.
No, I don't, because my cats are the best cats.
Okay,
so you know,
fine.
And I've spoken to a number of guests on this podcast about social media. It is a necessary evil. That's the problem. People say, "Why don't you come off Twitter?" Well, I quite like it.
Yep.
I find out things.
Yep.
And I need it.
Yeah, you need it for work. Actually, I get a lot of column commissions off the back of some random thing I've tweeted. So it's important for promoting the work that you've done as well. And as you say, you know, often news breaks first on Twitter, then appears on the websites a few minutes later. So you want to stay up to date. I have changed the way that I use social media hugely, actually, since I got ill a few years ago. I've got really strict time limits on what times I go on it. So after 10 p.m, it just shuts off on my phone. And I don't like that I've had to do this, but I don't actually see replies from people who I don't follow anymore unless I click on my individual tweet. And I know that I'm not in a particularly good place if I find myself scrolling through all the replies at the bottom of one of my tweets. And I'm really sad about that because I often miss a lot of insight from people who I just haven't come across before, who I don't follow, who've replied to me. But the sheer sort of drumbeat of people saying you're worthless, you're stupid, you know, all of this kind of, it's not the kind of thing you could report as abuse, but it's also not very nice to have it coming to you the whole time. You start to believe it. And so I thought, well, you know, I can probably do without this, particularly if you've got a mental illness, you've already got your head telling you that already. So I've really taken a step back and I do use Twitter a bit more to sort of broadcast and then retreat rather than, I don't pick arguments with people anymore. And sometimes, I log into Twitter at like 4 p.m. on a Sunday when I've had a lovely weekend and there'll be two journalists having a fight that's clearly gone on all day. And I do sort of think, well, that was your weekend. That was your way of spending Sunday. I mean, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Get some hobbies, guys.
It's, I think, unquestionably, I mean, I started Twitter, I think, when it first started. Mm. I've had an account for a long time. And I've noticed a change in it. And also a change in, I think I've become very kind of blasé now. It still hurts. And the thing is, I don't want to admit it hurts me when people tweet horrible things about me. Because then you're giving them the power. But it does.
Yeah, it does.
But it's amazing how inured I am to someone saying, you're shit and you look like a fat dyke or whatever it is. And you go,
yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah, you get stuff you've put on weight. Or when I came back from a lot of sick leave, clearly the antidepressants have made you fat. Yeah. And I was like, well, I mean, my dress is still fit. But also, like, what does that matter? Because I was on talking about John McDonnell's speech to the Labour Party conference. So even if I'd sort of put on 10 stone, it wouldn't make any difference to what I was saying. But you do sort of go, ha!
Yeah.
And then you go home and think, okay, I'm still thinking about this.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that especially my wife says, it can ruin a whole day.
Mm.
If I log onto Twitter and I see one person has said something, it can really affect me in a very negative way. And it's a waste of a good life, I think, sometimes.
Well, I mean, who's going to have on their gravestone, like, excellent Twitter abuser? It's really not, you know, life is a bit too short, I think. There are lots of other ways of wasting your time, I think.
So tell me then about what happened then. You've alluded to it earlier on, but talk me through what it is that happened.
So something really bad happened at the start of 2016. I mean, a bad thing had been going on for a very long time, but something particularly bad then happened, which I don't really want to talk about.
Absolutely fine.
And also, I don't think people really want to know about it either. It's sort of too miserable. But that is the kind of thing that would have taken anyone a long time to get over. And my attitude has always been, I've sort of brought up with a really strong Protestant work ethic. My attitude has always been work through your problems. Just, you know, if something awful is happening in your personal life, just do more work. And to a certain extent, I think that helps. But probably when you're covering the Brexit referendum, the murder of an MP, and then three or four party leadership contests, all in the space of about 6 months, while you're trying to deal with just, you know, all hell breaking loose in your own life, actually, that's just too much. It's a bit like, you know, we don't put ourselves through that much physical strain, do we? You wouldn't try to run a marathon up Snowdon with a broken leg. Everyone would say you were nuts. But actually, we pride ourselves in trying to damage ourselves by not even working through our problems, just ignoring our problems and just slamming ourselves in the office. And so I just started to react weirdly to things, and I was getting much more emotional. I was finding it harder to get through the day. I was finding it hard to concentrate. And I'd been at The Spectator for 4 or 5 years by this point. I'd been in Parliament since 2011, loved my job, loved working hard. And suddenly I couldn't do it. I couldn't think in sentences. I started to get really suicidal, started to hurt myself. It just a really hard time. And I wasn't sleeping, kept going. And then at the Conservative Party conference in 2016 in Birmingham, that was when I broke down. I couldn't write anymore. And that was pretty weird because, you know, all my life I've just been able to churn stuff out. And I was trying to write the email briefing that we send off every evening that analyses what's gone on that day. Everyone reads it. You know, the Prime Minister reads it. Everyone else in Westminster does too. And I wrote one sentence in like an hour, and in the end just had to message a colleague going, you're going to have to take over. I just can't do this. And then I had emergency treatment and then went off work. So, and eventually it was worked out that that was PTSD, which kind of makes sense given what had happened, and given that actually a lot of the features of being sick have involved flashbacks to bad things happening and feeling like I'm back in that situation again and sort of being unable to move on with my life. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what happened.
Well, it's, I mean, the thing is about depression, that specifically the PTSD from incidents. And one of the symptoms of depression that people don't necessarily know is that scattered thinking.
Yeah.
So in the book that I wrote about depression, one of the things I suggested is ask if you know someone who's got depression, ask them if you can do something for them. And by that I mean post a letter.
The impossible task.
Because sometimes when you're in the middle of it, you can't even go shopping because you don't know what to do.
No.
Everything is too much for you.
Absolutely.
That sometimes when people have depression, the very simple things help the most.
Totally.
I've got a basket full of stuff over there. Can you just deal with it?
Yeah.
So that I'm not then worrying about it.
Yeah.
And it's one of the kind of strange symptoms that sometimes people don't realise. It's not all sitting under a rain cloud on your sofa crying.
No.
That's not actually necessarily it's one of the symptoms of depression, but they come in many forms, don't they?
And actually that symptom, that sort of deep sadness, that sort of bleak feeling, it's horrendous and all-encompassing. But for me, it hasn't been the worst. It's been the impossible task, the inability to do the things that I normally don't even think about doing, you know, my job or, as you say, the really basic stuff. And I always know when my mental health is starting to wobble again because I stop bothering to do my hair and I don't wear matching clothes and I end up at home more and stuff. And I just end up, I mean, we all end up with sort of home workers' hair, don't we? And like bizarre tracksuit bottoms that are our kind of favourite working from home clothes. But when I get stuck in that and I start just eating cereal, those are the signs, because actually the idea of cooking something seems impossible. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, I'm sorry, we talked about language at the start of this podcast. That I use the words like mad and crazy and nuts to talk about myself because I find that separates my symptoms from who I actually am, from my kind of intrinsic Isabel and then the sort of the mad ill stuff. So it's not, I don't start thinking that's me. But it's mad, the distinction between healthy Isabel, who, you know, can do a full day. You know, I started really early this morning. I did the day programme. I've done PMQs. I've sort of bounced from thing to thing to thing, haven't thought about it. And then sick Isabel, who's mega impressed that she's got up and put moisturiser on.
Yep.
And if you haven't had a mental illness, even if you're incredibly compassionate, it's very hard to understand how someone's mind can flick between those two different states and seems so capable at some times, and then at other times it's just you know you can't think, and so you can't do.
I think
really hard.
I may have a control issue or two. I like to control everything. And to me, it staves off the anxiety and depression. Yeah. And I've got lists everywhere.
Uh-huh.
Lists. And it's taken my wife a long time to understand why I need to do things. So I've got lists. And she said, we'll do it tomorrow. I said, no, can we just do it now? Because if we do it now, I cross it off my list and it's done.
Yeah.
Because if we don't do it now, because she's very easy, Ozzy, we'll wake up tomorrow and you'll go, we'll do it another day. And then it'll never get done. And I feel anxious.
Yeah. I'm the same about unpacking hats. I just moved house and my partner was like, oh, we can sort those boxes out another time. No, because if we don't sort them out now, then bad things will happen. And actually, the bad thing that would have happened was we would have just shoved the boxes into a corner. But
yes, but it's the same. It's the same kind of, as I say, for me, I try and stave off the triggers for my anxiety.
Mm.
And one of them is controlling everything.
Mm.
Everything.
Mm.
I'm at my happiest if the fridge is full and I've planned every dinner for the week. Now, people listening will think that sounds boring or awful. That's, for me, it's happiness.
Yeah.
Then I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Then I don't need to think about it.
Yeah.
And it's done.
Have you ever done the what's the worst that could happen, though? Because part of my therapy, actually, there was... I can get really obsessed with perfection, actually, particularly in the way I appear to other people and sort of performance. And having people around for dinner can be a real source of stress for me because I want to, like, cook everything. You know, I make beautiful bread and then have a pudding and, you know, it's like five courses and everyone can't move by the end of it and I sort of feel like I've performed well. And I remember having people around for supper when I was unwell and having an entire counselling session on the fact that I was going to have to buy pudding. You know, what a load of money that I spent on this, like, not buying pudding situation. But I was mega stressed out because I was like, you know, they'll think I haven't made an effort for them. And the counsellor said, well, what's the worst that could happen if you go to M&S after this session and you buy a lemon tart? And I sort of sat there flabbergasted, like, you know, there was sort of all these scary thoughts raining in my head. And then I thought, well, I guess I'll eat it. And it's amazing when you break down the what's the worst that could happen.
My therapist got slightly annoyed at me. I recently went back into therapy again after recognising, I thought, you need to go in for a wee top-up, Susan, you know.
It's when others say it to you that it's even worse, because badly behaved have I been?
Yes. My wife was starting to make some noises and I thought, all right, OK. And she did that because apparently I catastrophise life.
Yeah, that's me too, yeah.
Whatever. And I was like, why do you always say blah, blah, blah? Anyway, so my therapist tried the what's the worst that could happen with me and she got very frustrated because it was, you know, what's the worst that could happen? I said, oh, people won't like me or whatever it was. And she said, well, is that so bad? And I went, yes, that is awful.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite at the stage yet of acknowledging that that's not a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Because I still think that is a terrible thing.
Yeah.
So
I've definitely got better at that over... That's not me saying that I haven't got 1,000 other things that therapists need to deal with, but the people won't like me thing, I have got a bit better at just thinking, oh, what the hell? Like, other people like me, so it doesn't matter so much.
It's funny,
my dog likes me.
My cats are indifferent towards me, but, you know.
Apart from when there's food.
Yes.
And then suddenly you are God.
It's one of those things, though, that some people I don't care about, but some people I really care about.
Yeah. And you know, for random people as well, aren't they? Who are sort of, they can be quite peripheral to your life, but suddenly you want their good opinion and that's all that matters.
The other thing that I think people sometimes struggle with if they've never been in a headspace similar to this is, I, the other day, woke up in a cold sweat about something that I'm pretty sure I said 12 years ago to somebody.
Oh, yeah. I have that as well.
I've actually become slightly obsessed by this particular incident, and it's nothing. It's really nothing.
Yeah.
But I've become slightly obsessed with what happened that time.
Yeah. And I think we all get those sort of, I don't think flashbacks are the right word because it's sort of got associations with proper PTSD flashbacks. But we have those moments where we look back to something really stupid we did say, where we really put our foot in it with someone. And I think we all do that, but I think with mental illness, you can end up fixating upon that and sort of wanting to atone for it in a way that becomes very damaging to your sense of self. Because ultimately, we're all doofuses. And part of learning to like ourselves is learning to live with our bad bits as well and the sort of messes we've made, as opposed to sort of, you don't, I've realised recently that I don't want to be one of those people who goes into therapy and says, you know, this person did this bad thing to me, this person did this bad thing to me, and never think about the fact that actually I've been quite selfish at times in my life and I've hurt people too. And coming to terms with that has been quite helpful as well, because it's made me realise that sometimes there are reasons for people not to like me.
Well, yes, I suppose that's, yes. That is,
and it's got nothing to do with pudding.
I mean, it's possible that I've become unpopular for other reasons. Possible. But I've gone to the extent of being so paranoid about what I say, because I'm such a forceful personality that some people don't take to me. And it was actually on the Strictly tour. So I was on the tour with all these people. They're very much, I love them, but they're very much out with my comfort zone.
Mm.
Dancers and celebrities and everything else. I had a bracelet made, which I wore on the tour, that had letters STFU on it, which is for shut the fuck up. For me. It wasn't for them, it was for me. So that every time I thought about saying something, I looked at the bracelet and I didn't say anything.
That's very impressive.
So I didn't have any of those experiences that I would then look back at and think. But I silenced myself to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Which was an extreme. Oh, going to extremes. What a strange thing for someone with a mental illness to do. To try and protect myself.
Yeah. And that's not good, is it? And often, I think for me, one of the things that I find hardest is the way I relate to people who are close to me. I can often overwrite that with things that have happened in the past to the extent that it really hurts them. So one of the features of PTSD that I've found and that lots of people around me have found really surprising is anger. I've never really been an angry person until I got ill, but my God, I've been angry since then. And it's not the sort of, you know, the righteous anger about what happened. It's often random flare-ups of anger with people who are entirely innocent. So, you know, one of my best friends, Alice, who I lived with at university, was just trying to look out for me one evening and made some suggestion. I went absolutely nuts at her. And she sort of backed away. And then the next day I thought, Alice was just giving me some advice. And I'd shouted at her and I felt terrible. And it happens with my partner the whole time that I can go absolutely mad at him and accuse him of all sorts of things. I've accused colleagues of plotting against me, which is so embarrassing, because it's one thing saying that to your partner and then you sort of, you know, have a gin together and make up and you relax. But with colleagues, there's always a slight separation in your relationship. And to introduce that level of madness into a working relationship, I still haven't quite come to terms with the damage that my illness has done in that sense, actually. And I know that I've sort of irreparably damaged some relationships, or my illness has anyway, but that sort of sense of rising anger is something I'm still desperately trying to control, because it can just end up with me particularly sending angry messages to people going, oh, fuck you, and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even very sweary until 3 years ago, and now I'm like the sort of trooper, but not in a good way.
My anger is always directed towards me.
Oh, is it?
Always. Okay. It's very rarely directed towards anyone else. It's always myself, which is that's why my escape's exercise. I box.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
Ah, see, my counsellor kept saying to me, you should take up boxing. So I do a lot of sport. She was like, you've got a lot of anger there. You need to deal with that. But
it's amazing.
But do you feel, I'd feel really bad about hitting someone, or I'd like hit them
wrong?
No.
I've got a, well,
you've got punch bag.
I started with a personal trainer.
He's getting paid to be hit, so that's okay.
Things.
Yeah.
And I've got a punch bag in my garage. And when I feel it starting, I go down, I put on the gloves, and I punch the punch bag for a while. Really punch that punch bag in the privacy of my garage. I swear, I shout, I kick it, I do whatever, and then it's gone.
That's great.
So it's a very private thing, actually.
Yeah, because you sort of need to let it all hang out, don't you, basically? And so much of our life is us controlling where we are. Even when we're in sort of a mental health crisis, there are times when I've sort of sat on the tube feeling like I've got this, like, catch over me where, you know, I'm a bulging cupboard, and if you just unlock that catch, suddenly it would go, whoa! Mm-hmm. Whereas actually having that private space where you can just let out your anger mm-hmm. is really rare.
Yeah, and it's genuinely one of the best things of just. And I was doing it first of all with my personal trainer, and I liked it anyway because it's good exercise. And then he said, "Can you think of someone that you really you're angry about?"
Okay.
And I could.
Yeah.
And he said, "Think of that person's face," and the difference was Gosh. Incredible. And I could only keep going for about 10, 15 seconds.
Yeah.
But the way you feel afterwards, because you feel like you've expended all the negativity in a positive way.
Wow.
So I mean, for me, exercise is it. And I also weightlift.
Oh, do you?
Deadlifting.
Oh.
Because when you've got the weight and you think about the thing, I think about the whatever's in my head and I channel it all into the anger and aggression yep. of lifting the weight. And then it's gone.
See, for me, running fast and hard does do some of that, but the punch bag idea, actually, I do find really, really compelling. And one of the things that I have found really, really helpful in my sort of exercise regime, which that makes me sound a bit like a sort of Instagram influencer who has, like, you know, green juice at 6 a.m. and then yoga. But I do try to do some kind of vigorous exercise every day, even if it's just cycling into work, just because I find it really keeps my mind in a better place. But the most effective thing for me is cold water swimming. Oh my God, it's made such a difference. I mean, okay. I do loads of running. I did the marathon this year. Love running. That makes a huge difference. Lots of people talk about that. But I signed a contract to write a book on nature and mental health, and I had a whole chapter in the plan about cold water swimming. Hated swimming when I was at school. I used to bunk off the whole time. I used to forge sick notes. I had a period that lasted a month because I had a male teacher, and so I knew he wasn't going to question
it. Okay,
so,
yep. mm-hmm.
yeah. I just hated it. I hated chlorine. It made my face go all itchy. I just hated the whole thing. Then I'd signed this contract to write a book that involved swimming. And so I thought, right, I've just got to go and do it, because I'd read loads of stuff about the impact that the cold can have on you. And I can't believe the difference it's made.
Really?
Really. I mean, in the winter when there's ice on the water and the water is like 1 or 2 degrees, what it does, not just physiologically, but psychologically, is incredible. And there's lots of research that says it actually helps you to tame your fight or flight response. And so if you've got PTSD where you've got a lot of fight going on because you've got so much anger, and you've got a lot of flight because you're freaked out as well, that's really, really useful. And if you think about it, you get into water that's got ice on it, it's bloody cold, and I just do it wearing a swimming costume and then 5 millimetre gloves. And you have this kind of shock and you sort of go, and then you have to learn to get going and to swim. And so by taming that physical fright, you start to tame the mental fright of the water. And I have found that I've coped with situations that would have sent me bananas about a year ago much better because of that swimming. And so this winter I was swimming at least 3 times a week throughout the winter. You know, the colder it got, the happier I was, basically, because of what it did for my mind, for that shock. And you feel so alert but calm for the rest of the day. It wakes you up, but it stops you from feeling like your head is you know, those sort of old Wild West films where there's like cowboys and Indians running at each other in double speed. That's often what my mind feels like when I'm not in a good place. But the swim just slows it all down, so it's on, yeah, you know, it's more ponies plodding around happily in a field instead.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's funny because the reason I like to do exercise that's so vigorous and horrific, I feel like I'm going to vomit.
I like it.
What I like about running.
I like it really, really bad.
Yeah.
I do a class called Grit Cardio.
Oh my goodness. My gym. Do you all take like Instagram selfies before it?
Absolutely not. And it's, I mean, it's the most horrific thing. I mean, it's just horrible. But for that 30 minutes or an hour, my mind is still, because all I'm concentrating on is not dying.
Yeah, is the pain.
Because yeah. I'm having to go, because I refuse to allow myself not to do that properly, because then I'd be a failure and that's the worst thing in the world.
People wouldn't like you.
People wouldn't like me if I was...
If I couldn't do my
grit cardio class properly, everyone would hate me. And so I go for it and it's horrible. But for that, it's like a blessed relief for me.
Yeah, yeah.
The only other time I feel that is if I get a really good podcast. That's why I love podcasts.
Oh, are you saying that this podcast is so painful that you're not thinking about yourself?
No, if I find a really good podcast, especially I love true crime podcasts. I love a good true crime podcast.
Houseplant podcast, actually. Yeah. That's my little guilty pleasure.
I listen to an Agatha Christie one. It's amazing. Two Americans... read and rate every Agatha Christie mystery novel. It's the most quaint, beautiful.
Oh, that sounds really cute.
It is really lovely, and I think it's every Saturday or Sunday, and it pops up, and I go, "Oh, great!" And it's sparkling cyanide or whatever, and you just listen to two nice people talking about an Agatha Christie book,
and
you get transported. Yeah, yeah, and it just takes you in a way that television doesn't anymore.
No,
because there's so much going on.
Yep. And you end up phone fiddling when you're watching TV. Yeah. I've taken up knitting to stop phone fiddling.
Right.
Actually, that's another reason I'm not doing much social media, is I'm always like knitting a sock. In fact, one of my colleagues earlier was teasing me that at some point, if I get bored in a podcast, I'm just going to get my knitting out and start like making a hat just to make a point. But yeah, you get so distracted with TV that you're only ever half watching. Mm-hmm. Even if it's something really good like Killing Eve, mm-hmm. you're still on Twitter.
It's interesting because I went through my worst phase of depression, self-harm, suicidal thoughts as a teenager.
Uh-huh.
So I was about 13, 14, 15, 16, about that time. And then for about 10 years after that, I didn't talk to anyone about it.
Oh, that's
interesting. Because I was very frightened of telling it, because it was so badly dealt with when I was 16 that I then decided to tell everyone I was well for 10 years.
Right, yeah.
And I wasn't well.
Yeah.
Because... I mean, the stigma of mental... It's not so much the stigma of mental illness. People didn't know what the hell to do.
No, they freeze, don't they?
Yeah, people absolutely freeze.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, I'm a comedian who can say that I have depression and everyone's like, I want another comedian with depression.
Oh, yeah.
When I was a lawyer, I don't think they would have dealt with it as well. And it is difficult when you do have something and you have to tell people about it. It is a difficult thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I think... I'm lucky in that, you know, I only got ill 3 years ago, and in the years leading up to that, we just had an explosion of people talking about being ill. We'd had MPs in that amazing debate in 2012 talking about how they had OCD, postnatal depression and so on, particularly male MPs, actually. I think that made a huge difference, having the Charles Walker and Kevin Jones talking about their mental illnesses, because that's such a taboo, is men talking about mental health. So I think the political world had sort of become kinder, but I think where there is still a stigma is people will sort of make very supportive noises, be very sort of, oh gosh, I'm so sorry, you know, it's terrible, I know my aunt has had depression, blah blah blah, but when it actually manifests itself in the way that mental illnesses do, beyond anything, you know, anything beyond crying basically, people then don't like it, because they're like, oh, not that kind of mental illness, not when you're actually like, you know, when you're paranoid or when you're angry. They don't see that as part of your mental illness. They then get sort of freaked out, upset, take it personally and so on. And I think if you talk to people for whom, you know, their mental illness has hospitalised them because they've got a psychotic illness, for instance, or something, you know, something like bipolar or schizophrenia, or borderline personality disorder, those illnesses that are less well understood, slightly scarier symptoms, I think they feel the stigma has not lifted at all. People are okay about depression, but when it comes to anything that involves your mind kind of telling you things that aren't real,
yes,
which is a feature actually of anxiety and depression as well,
yes,
and of PTSD. You know, the other night apparently I had a night terror where I said that someone from my past had broken into the house, and apparently I went downstairs and had a look. I don't remember any of this. my partner was properly freaked out in the morning. He's fine with that, but a lot of people in the rest of the world are not so fine. Think of someone who I know who had a psychotic breakdown recently. Lots of people kind of thought what he was doing was funny. It wasn't funny. He was really sick. And they hadn't thought, actually, that's what people who are manic do because they're sick. In the same way as if you've got a stomach problem, you vomit.
Yes, absolutely.
But people are less forgiving. You know, I say sorry so many more times because of what my mental illness has done than I would do if I'd thrown up on someone's shoes. I would still be very apologetic about that. But
you'd probably apologise and leave it.
Exactly.
Whereas I continually apologise.
For years.
Yes.
Yeah.
But absolutely for you. Absolutely. Yeah. And we have something in our house, compliment Sunday.
Where oh, my God.
My wife compliments me and I have to accept it. and not apologise. Because I'm terrible at that. Because if you say, oh, you're quite good, like, well, you know, I'm not, I mean, there are better, there people are better. And I've oh, you know.
Yeah.
And it's...
What happens if you don't? Do you have like a swear jar?
She just keeps making it very clear that I have to accept the compliment. She's from Edinburgh. She can be quite intimidating. So it's I think my life got better when I left law because I did feel that I could be slightly freer. Because I think if I had a 9-to-5 job. I'm actually very well now, and I have been for a long time. Mm. But in the times where I perhaps didn't want to leave the house, or I was struggling, especially when you'd work 9-to-5 and then you have to do social events in the evening, it would have been quite difficult.
Yeah, and I have I've changed the way I work massively. I'm now self-employed, which has its upsides in the sense that I can decide what time I start, and if I want to work from home, then I can. So I can carry on working. Whereas if I were in a 9-to-5 office job, I wouldn't turn up and then I wouldn't work. But obviously, if you're self-employed, you don't get paid when you're ill.
Yes.
And sick pay actually comes from either your savings or, in my case, an overdraft or a loan even. Mm-hmm. But I think I was in... Actually, people say, oh, you know, Isabel, it's great that you've talked about your mental illness and it just shows how kind the world has become. And I think that is true. But I also think I was in a really privileged position anyway. You know, I'd been a political journalist for quite a while. I'd already had my first book deal. I'd won awards. I was about to say people knew who I was, but that makes me sound like Ron Burgundy from Anchorman. Like, people know me. But I had a sort of reasonable reputation. MPs knew who I was and I could, you know, I had contacts and stuff. And most importantly, my boss, Fraser Nelson at The Spectator, is one of the best managers I think you could find in the media by a country mile, and was just really, really supportive and was happy for me to talk about not just the fact that I was mentally ill, but what mental illness meant to me, rather than some bosses who'd be like, OK, crazy here's talking again about being crazy. You know, this is just too embarrassing for our brand. And he gave me extra time off and so on. So my experience doesn't really compare to what a lot of people I know go through, where their bosses are sympathetic for 6 weeks and then are like, okay, you know,
you must be better now.
This depression has gone on for too long. I've given you your allocated sick pay. Mm-hmm. And you can understand from the boss's point of view as well. It's tough because if you've got someone who keeps going off sick, they're starting to worry about the impact on their business. But I don't think it's generally handled very well at all. And I think a lot of people feel that they can't be honest about their mental illnesses because they'll get sacked or they won't get promoted. They won't go any further.
Yes. I think they'll stagnate. My concern was always that if you opened up my personnel file, it would always have she's a mad bitch written on the top of it. Do you know what I mean? Watch her.
That's the other thing about being self-employed is it's just your own personnel file. You write about yourself.
I think as well, though, that for me, one of the major issues is finances. Mm. So I'm fortunate in that I can pay for a woman to listen to me talk for an hour. And the big thing was, and I'm asked consistently, oh, things are so much better, what with you talking about it and Stephen Fry talking about it. And you go, yeah, sure, okay, it's okay. Yeah, it's okay. But if you genuinely, if you go, and I know I've got a lot of friends with a lot of issues, PTSDs and traumas and everything else. And, you know, I often see on Facebook, that's me finally got my appointment after 6, 7, 8 months of waiting for a specialist.
Yep.
So The issue is you pluck up the courage to say that you're not well.
Yep.
You manage to find a GP that will listen to you. No disrespect to GPs. You're under a lot of pressure. I'm not suggesting you're bad.
Some of them are.
Some of them are not great. Some of them are under incredible time pressures. And then you, what happens after that? So you pluck up the courage. You talk about yourself. And then if you don't have the finances, 8 months later you might see somebody.
Yeah. I mean, my GP said, look, do you have the money to go private for your therapy? Well, yes, I do. At that stage, I had a savings account, which I then spent on my therapy. And then when we were talking about a referral to a psychiatrist to get a diagnosis of PTSD, do you have the money to go private for psychiatry? Because it'll probably take maybe half a year to a year to get just your first appointment. And I had a mate who, his life was not going particularly well. Things were going badly for him mentally. He went for an assessment and they said, oh, well, things aren't bad enough for you yet, so we can't put you on our waiting list. And in the 3 months after that, his life genuinely blew up. And I kind of think, well, you know, he's recognised there's a problem at quite an early stage, which is quite unusual for a lot of people, particularly, again, men. And then he's just been told he's not sick enough. So what, he should get sicker? He should make things worse?
But that's,
I mean, that genuinely happened to him.
No, absolutely. I think the problem is if you can't get seen by someone, then it's a crisis and then you're seen.
Yeah.
But you've got
then
to
you're
the
in hospital.
But then you've got the crisis situation. Now, specifically when it comes to, I never want anyone to go through what I went through as a teenager. I mean, they're much better about young people's mental health.
Yeah.
But if you look at the stats for young boys in particular and the mental health issues and suicide rates, they're alarming.
Mm.
But again, you get your son to admit how he's feeling. You go to the GP.
And it's almost like you've opened them up. You've sort of cut them open. They've got a wound there. And then you just leave it there festering. So in a sense, it almost feels worse when you've admitted how hard you're finding things. You've talked about your feelings, which for a lot of people can feel very raw and exposing. But then you're just left hanging. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've talked to people who've said, I felt like the health service didn't think I was worth being treated, that I was, you know, not good enough even for the doctors. It's the lies that our depression tells us, but it's
absolutely
also reinforced by the way that mental health is funded and treated in this country.
And I think the reason I get angry at Brexit is that while everyone's screaming about Brexit, there's a lot of stuff that we're not talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the thing for me that's annoying, that for another week where this is the focus of everything, the other things are happening that we're not sorting.
And there's an excuse for any Prime Minister to say, I'm a bit busy at the moment. You don't have to tackle difficult issues because everyone sees you trying to tackle Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so preoccupied with how difficult that is that you get away with not doing as much as you should be doing.
And I think, and you do not need to comment on this in the slightest, Isabel, that when a Prime Minister has used some of the worst language I've ever, no, not I've heard worse language about.
So say, aren't you from Glasgow?
Yes. About that I've heard a politician use about some members of the gay community.
Yep.
Given that the mental health amongst gay teenagers is not great.
Yep. And child abuse as well. Yeah, Boris Johnson said, I'm very happy to comment on this.
Oh, great. Okay, great. I didn't know whether or not you could do it.
Yeah, it's fine. But you know, Boris Johnson talked about the inquiry into child sexual abuse and he said that they had spaffed money up the wall.
Yes.
Which, it's not a very nice turn of phrase anyway, but it's so deliberately upsetting to people who've been abused. And if you know anything about people who've been through particularly childhood abuse, but any form of, you know, domestic abuse, sexual abuse, rape and so on, actually very little things can set them off into a complete tumble of reliving what they've been through. And often the disbelief and casual treatment that they receive from people throughout the rest of their life, they say, can feel worse than the actual incident itself. And I find Boris Johnson's lack of empathy on that really worrying, that you can think that that's a funny word to use, or that you can think that people won't notice. You can think that you can get to that level in politics and not think, actually, I think that might hurt some people. I don't really want to hurt people.
Well, as someone,
I want to be funny. You know, you know how to be funny.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily need to involve beating up people who've had a really shit time.
No, it doesn't at all. And I think the thing is the lack of knowledge that using a phrase like bum boys,
yep,
which I can virtually guarantee has been shouted at a poor boy somewhere as he's had the shit kicked out of him.
Exactly.
Somewhere.
Exactly.
Is a bad thing.
I obviously just think it's a bit immature. I mean, come on, he's got an amazing command of the English language and several other languages as well. Can't he find, you know, a better use of language than something that he's heard at school?
I think the reason I'm talking about that is that our parliament, our prime minister, the leader of the country, if you like to put it like that, in a way should be somebody, I would hope, who would understand that if someone comes to them for a case for mental health for LGBTQ teenagers, would go, this is a good thing.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the concern for a lot of people who have empathy is it's already underfunded, it's already marginalised, mental health, and especially for young people, but generally. You know, a friend of mine had a postpartum psychosis, proper psychosis.
Which is terrifying.
And eventually went to speak to somebody about it and managed to get funding, but it took a long time. And that's a psychosis caused not by her.
Yeah.
Caused by the hormones in our body going absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
So for you, I still go to therapy. Do you go to psychologist, psychiatrist? What kind of?
So
do you use?
I'm actually not having any therapy at the moment, for the first time in 3 years, and I'm just sort of seeing how that's going. At the moment, I feel like I'm okay.
Yep.
And I feel like I've got a good support network, and I feel like a lot of the things I learnt in therapy have now become habits. But that's not to say that in a couple of years' time I won't feel ready to talk about some stuff that I found too hard in initial therapy. So in 2017, I came back to work at the start of 2017 and started doing psychotherapy. And that was too much. It felt like I was paying a lot of money, to go every Monday at 5 p.m. to sit in a room and be the most upset I'd ever been in my life for an hour. And I just knew, you know, 5 p.m. Monday, that's where I'm going to be. And the way it opened me up for the rest of the week was just too much at the time. I was too acutely ill, actually. I needed to get my medication sorted. I needed to feel like there was stability in my life before I could start talking about really awful stuff from the past. So it might be that I feel I can sort of deal with that as I go through life and as I jump into more lakes with ice on.
Absolutely.
But it might be that I need someone to help me talk through that. And, you know, it's the same as lots of things. I'm able to repressurise my boiler. I'm not qualified to install it, and I'm perfectly happy to pay someone to come and do that.
Yeah.
And similarly, I'm able to sort certain mental things out myself, but I'm more than happy to get a professional to work me through that for however long it takes.
My issue is that I reach a level where I can feel physically I have to stop talking.
Yeah.
Like, I can't physically say the words.
Yeah.
I can't physically say.
Yeah.
And so I went to a lovely therapist who left many years ago, and I thought, I need to go again, and started with a new therapist. And I can't talk to her yet. I can't talk to her.
What, because, I mean, there are things that I didn't tell my therapist who I had for 2 or 3 years. I didn't tell her until about 2.5 years in.
See, I think it's going to... I don't trust her, you see.
Yeah. It's not think they're suspicious. It's just that these are deep things, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah. And I've not told them to my wife or my family necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
And suddenly you're expected to sit and go, okay, here's something, right? Here's something that I can barely admit to myself.
Yeah. And I've only there just you met you.
Yes. But would you like to... And I'm sitting in your living room. Would you like to... And I think actually the older I've got, the less trusting I've got. So it's actually worse now than it was.
Yeah. I think also it's funny, isn't it? Because you know that they're paid and trained not to be judgmental. But these things that you want to talk about are such that you are just terrified of their reaction, even when you ultimately tell them.
I'm ultimately terrified, being honest, of being sectioned. I'm terrified of it.
Okay.
I'm terrified of it. Because when I was 16, I went into hospital. and it was the worst experience of my life. I'm sure it's much better now,
yeah,
but it was horrific.
Yeah.
And so
were you on an adult ward?
No, I was in the teen ward, but everyone there was, I mean, I was ill, but I wasn't very ill, and there were some very ill people there,
yeah,
and you just kind of sit like one flew over the cuckoo's nest going, yeah, Jesus, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And I was so traumatised after that. And even now, I don't ever want to admit necessarily if I'm feeling down, because I think they're just going to phone. They're going to phone up the, you know, the white van.
Yeah.
And off I go.
Yeah.
And then I'll never get out.
Yeah.
And my life's over.
Yeah.
So, catastrophise, you say, Susan? Is that what you do? But I genuinely worry,
yeah,
that if I, there's nothing bad in my head, but I worry if I talk about genuinely how I feel sometimes,
people will take it too seriously.
Absolutely,
yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So instead, yeah, I make light of
back from it, going, no, I'm not as ill as I said I was.
Absolutely. And, yeah. If you say some of the things and thoughts, yeah, in your head, you can't take that back.
Yes. Yeah. Things can't be unsaid, and if you're still remembering stuff you said 12 years ago,
yeah,
and sort of eating yourself up over it, you start to think, well, why would I open up another decade of horror?
It's a strange thing. And often when people listen to this podcast, you'll get messages from people saying that they have really identified with what people have said and it's given them the courage to go and speak to someone. It takes a long time. This is the thing.
Mm.
And it depends what pace you want to go at,
mm,
what your therapist is like, mm, what your support network is like. This is the,
yeah,
thing.
Another thing that I feel hugely fortunate for, I've got wonderful family and friends, and lots of people end up being really isolated and not having that, and mm-hmm, that's not their fault. It's just, I just got lucky, basically. I've just got nice people who have stayed in touch. And
so it's important,
yeah,
I always think it's important before you to just be kind to yourself,
yeah,
and to not be disappointed you're not cured after a week.
Oh my gosh, that was one of the biggest breakthroughs for me, was when I came back to work initially. I wanted to talk about how I was beating depression, and I wanted to feel like I was on the road to recovery. And then every time I had a relapse, I would get so upset because I thought, I'm not getting better. And now I've got to the stage where I actually think I'm probably always going to have this black hole inside of me, but I'm just going to get better at learning how to walk around it. And, you know, my therapy gives me the sort of the Ordnance Survey map of that. And my medication keeps me from wobbling all over the place and falling in. And that has given me a kind of, an acceptance of my illness that has made me far less frantic about getting better. And I'm not saying that means I now suddenly go, oh, it's wonderful that I have these paranoid delusions and flashbacks. You know, they've contributed so much to my life. It's more just that I'm not going to wish my life away when actually there is a lot that I can still enjoy, even when I'm very sick. And I'm sure you get this as a comic, actually, because people often say this to me as a writer, that, oh, but you wouldn't be who you are without your mental illness. And, you know, doesn't it make you...
makes you a better comedian, Susan.
Look at all
Susan.
These brilliant, yes, people in the past who've had mental illness. And it's like, well, that, I mean, there may be a link between mental illness and the sheer brilliance that you and I obviously have.
Mm.
But also, I was established in my career before I got sick, and I didn't need my mental illness to establish me in my career. Actually, I've had to really slow down my career over the past few years, and I'm not earning as much. And, you know, I've seen other people who were junior to me go whoosh past me, and I've had to sort of come to terms with that. So I'm not sure my mental illness has been the kind of CV enhancing thing that people try to kindly say that it is. But at the same time, the way I've learned to deal with my mental illness has allowed me to experience some things that I would never have done, and that I'm so grateful I have experienced. So swimming, for instance, and I've got really into wildlife photography, and just the amazing sort of spiritual experiences of, for instance, watching the starlings in a murmuration over,
oh, wow,
Brighton Pier, mm-hmm, the way they sort of move like a heartbeat in a cloud, and taking photos of that, or taking photos of barn owls, or... the other day, actually, I had a very exciting nature photography experience, which was I saw a male digger wasp having sex with a fly orchid. And it's an extremely rare event. And it's called pseudo-copulation, which sounds like a Red Hot Chili Peppers song. And I got to photograph it. And everyone is now turning this podcast off. But...
No, we're using that for the trailer as well. That's the absolute bringer.
But this orchid has evolved to look, feel and smell like a sexy female virgin dig a wasp. And the male comes out and he can see and feel and smell this flower. And he gets all excited and he pounds away on it. And the flower drops its pollen onto the wasp and then he flies off. And actually, I wouldn't have
the
got...
The producer's now Googling.
The producer's leaving. Just thinking, who is this filthy woman talking about plant sex? But actually, I wouldn't even have known a flower could existed if I didn't have a mental illness and I'd been off sick and I'd been trying to find ways of occupying myself. And so, yes, I would rather be sane and be able to have just, you know, whizzed up the career ladder and be all powerful. But there are things that I can say, my life didn't work out that way, but it's gone a different route that has not been wholly miserable and grey. And I have been able to find amazing things as a result of trying to get better that have been pretty cool. Like orchids having sex with wasps. I'm just going to keep repeating that over and over again.
The best thing, the day I think my life got better was the day I stopped trying to change the fact I had depression.
Yeah.
And instead thought, well, I've got it.
How am I going to live with this?
Let's see how we can make this a manageable thing. Let's see how we can do that.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because actually, if you had a physical illness, you would have got to that point much earlier.
Oh, absolutely.
Like if you'd had your leg cut off, and I know people get annoyed with the broken leg analogy, because there's lots of problems with it. But with a physical illness, you have the conversation about how to deal with your new normal much earlier than you do with mental illness, because you have this hope that suddenly you're going to get better. And maybe you will, but actually it would be much better to learn to live around...
Yeah, and I mean, it's basic things like I stopped drinking as much, yeah. Exercising more, yeah. I cut out of my life the people that were making me feel shit about myself.
Yeah, and you can do that because you're like, I'm too ill to see
yes,
you.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very depressed. Yeah, you have to leave now.
Yes.
We actually moved house because a lot of the stress was coming from where we were living.
Oh, really?
Yes, okay. Just, we were in a flat and communal... roof we were paying for all. I was worried all the time about what would happen.
Okay.
So we moved to somewhere where all those stresses were gone. So, you know, I'm much better now at saying, this is what's causing me a problem. Is this changeable or do I have to do something about it?
Yeah.
And in that way, and I've got a very understanding partner who understands I need to do the Tesco shop on a Thursday and I need to arrive and I need to know what's in it and I need to know what I'm having for my dinner.
Do you not find, I find that sort of, I don't particularly like talking about my partner and stuff, but one thing I would say is unconditional love is amazing. And
yes.
Actually the support of a partner, and so many people I talk to who have mental health problems talk about this, that I've realised how much of love is unconditional, because my illness means that a lot of the time I'm quite unlovable and my partner has stuck with me and he's clearly not just along for sort of a fun ride anymore.
Yeah.
And
he's not just along for the wasp sex.
Exactly. I promised him wasp sex.
He's there for more. I think it's... Someone came up to my wife in the toilets of a club once that I was performing in and said, but you're so lucky, it must be a laugh a minute living with Susan. And I think she was just... She couldn't... The woman didn't understand why my wife was laughing so much, because it's as far away from fun as you can imagine.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'd say that about living with any comedian, but specifically one that has depression and anxiety.
Mm.
It's hellish. Mm. I make her choose what she's having for dinner before we go to a restaurant. And she's not allowed to change it because that upsets me. And she's not allowed to have the special because only a mad person has the special. That's just been added at the last minute.
I think it's really important if you have a partner, if you're the partner and your other half is the one with the mental illness, for you to be able to say, this is really hard, I'm finding this really hard. Like my partner has actually had his own psychiatric and psychological help as a result of my illness. I mean, he's had pre-existing mental health problems, so he understands. In fact, we got written up by one diary piece as like Mr. and Mrs. Depression, which I found hilarious. Like, what a thing to bring us together.
Lovely. I look forward to seeing it. Royal Ascot with your sashes on.
With little hats.
Yes, absolutely. It's just us, the depression.
With the
morning,
sad emojis.
Morning, terrible day, isn't it?
But he found my illness in its most acute phase incredibly hard to deal with. And I think it's really important for people to be able to say that, rather than this kind of, oh, you must be so caring and wonderful. Actually, it is really hard. And, you know, he's lost patience with me at times when I've been mad, and he's needed people to support him. And I think it's really important for people to be able to be open and honest about that, rather than saying, you know, my other half has bipolar or whatever, and it's all absolutely fine. You know, my I'm really
is,
good at caring.
My wife is a very lucky woman to have snagged a catch like me. Yeah. We're going to have to stop so you can get back to Westminster.
Wasp sex.
Westminster, not wasp. Jeez, I never knew this was going to happen. I always like to end the podcast by asking my guest for the, you can say whatever you like, final word about mental illness, about how you're feeling about anything you want. You finish off by saying whatever you want about advice to people or anything, tips, whatever you want to say.
Okay. I think some advice I would give to people is try to find a bit of exercise that really works for you, particularly something that's outdoor. And don't make it so much of a regime that you start beating yourself up when you're not doing it, but just see it as something that's going to really enrich your life and your mind, because there's a lot of evidence that exercising in the outdoors can really help, not cure, but help your mental illness. And for me, that's been the single biggest thing in all of my treatment for mental illness, is getting outdoors and watching wasps having sex. There we go. Got it in now, one last time.
So, Isabel, if people want to know more about you, which after the constant references to wasps, I doubt, are you on some form of social media if people wish to catch up with what you're doing?
I am. I'm on Twitter as at Isabel Hardman and on Instagram as at Isabel.Hardman.
Oh, she changed it up there. Whoop, whoop. Yep. Changed it up. Wow. I'm Susan Kalman on Twitter and official Susan Kalman on Instagram. And I'm under official Susan Kalman, because when I did Strictly, everyone else had official Debbie McGee, and I thought, I better do that then, even though I don't think anyone else is going to be the unofficial Susan Kalman, do you?
I'm totally going to go home and set up that account now.
The unofficial Susan Kalman, where it's just pictures of wasps. Thanks very much, Isabel. It's been lovely. Thank you very much indeed. Now go back and learn what's happening with the country.
Yep, I will do. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Mrs. Brightside. If you like the show, why not subscribe? We're available everywhere you can download podcasts. And if you've already subscribed, why not tell a friend? Next week, I'll be talking to
the glorious Nick Helm.
So I thought that by the time I got to Edinburgh, I'd be all fixed. You know, I'll be ready to write a show. This show's about mental health. My show's called Phoenix from the Flames. My show is about me coming back to stand-up and coming back to Edinburgh and coming back to being like, yeah, I'm back. My brain is working again and all this. And the whole process of writing the show has been absolutely... I'm so open on stage. I feel like I could burst into tears at any point.
Susan Kalman's Mrs. Brightside is hosted, appropriately enough, by me, Susan Kalman. The producer is Benjamin Sutton and is a BBC Studios production for Acast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.